call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Friday, May 6, 2005. Pretty full agenda, somewhat intimidating, but we're going to get through these bills today. Is the final date for regular consideration of House bills, which is why the agenda is pretty substantial. Note that we will not be hearing House Bill 2789. That bill is no longer necessary. And we have a couple of bills here that we're going to preserve for future consideration. Also, there is a measure, House Bill 2475, which is listed, colleagues, that will not be heard till 5 o'clock. That's because of our 48-hour rule. We couldn't. We had to put that bill up to do some work on that bill, but we couldn't. We couldn't put it before 5 o'clock. It's not necessary for you to be here. I will just come. I'll show up here at 5 o'clock and tap the bill and then adjourn the hearing, adjourn the meeting.
Can you do that when there's not a quorum?
Yeah, we don't need a quorum to open a public hearing. We just need a quorum to do any work on a bill, so there really won't be any work. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3108. And who's the proponent of it? Actually, Representative Tomei, that's your bill.
Well, I've forgotten stuff.
Okay, all right.
I'll learn my bill.
Okay. Jane Ellen White-Ants and Catherine White.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while the folks are coming up, you should have attached to your SMS a -4 amendment and a -5 amendment. The -4 amendment basically is the amendment that is replacing the bill, which is the department is here to speak to that, and the -5 amendments are at the request of the Oregon Coalition on Developmental Disabilities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good morning. Welcome.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance, and I'm the Medicare Modernization Act Project Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3108 as amended in the -4 amendment. These amendments do two things for the department. First, the amendments allow the department to perform a state recovery for the money we must send the federal government for the new Medicare prescription drug benefit that starts January 1st, 2006.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a brief question? Are we on Amendment 5?
Excuse me, -4?
-4, thank you.
Without the amendment before you, we expect a loss of revenue of approximately $2 million in the coming biennia, and an increasing amount over the subsequent biennias as well. The amendments also remove the statutory reference to the time frames that the Health Services Commission's report for the prioritized health services list is in effect. And the reason we need this is that this allows us the opportunity to work with the federal government within their time frames to get our client benefit packages, our managed care contracts, and rates in place, because the federal government must approve those, and sometimes they don't do them within our statutory time frames. So that we ask that you approve the -4 amendments and also remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, since it doesn't have an actual fiscal impact at this point. Appreciate your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
So you're extending the clawback to the estates of dead people?
Correct.
How about that? All right.
Extending the clawback?
I'm sorry?
Or are clawing back? Can you possibly run quickly through this amendment so we know what's in here? Could you just give us a...
Sure. Chairman Dalto, Representative Greenwood. What the first part of the amendments do, if you return to them. On page 2 of the amendments, line 1 through line 6, this basically defines the clawback. And for those of you who haven't heard the term yet, what clawback is the amount of money we must pay the federal government for switching the prescription drug coverage from the Medicaid, Medicare dual eligibles from the state to the federal government. And we must pay a certain part of that money to the federal government to defray their costs for the new prescription drug benefit. And this basically allows us to define that clawback as general assistance and to perform a state recovery on that.
If I can ask, That section defines general assistance.
Yes.
General assistance isn't the clawback, is that right? General assistance is a category of...
It is a category of public assistance, sir.
All right. So that's not the clawback. This defines what's included in general assistance, which means in payments to an individual?
Correct. It's a subcategory of public assistance, and it's one of the components that we already do with state recovery. So basically what this is doing is taking the clawback amount and rolling it into that definition of general assistance that we already have in state statute.
Mr. Chair, if I can, Madam Chair, if
yes.
I can follow up because
yes,
I do
follow
want to
follow.
This amendment isn't about clawback and what we pay to the federal government. This amendment is about recovery from the states. Is that what we're talking about here? It'd be very helpful if you...
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Greenlake, you're right. What this is about estate recovery.
This is about estate recovery. And currently, we recover from the states a certain amount of paid general assistance, and all this amendment is doing is adding to what we usually recover from an estate an amount that's equal to the amount we pay to the federal government on behalf of that recipient. Is that?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Greenlake, that's correct.
Thank you. That takes care of it. I know where we are now.
All right. Thank you, Jane Ellen. Catherine White, we have an amendment of a different variety. Are we going to put that amendment into this bill? Are you ready? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're here to request the inclusion of the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 3108.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm sorry, Catherine White with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. For many, many years, families who had children with disabilities made that excruciating decision to place their children in institutions like Fairview, and for many of these families, it was less painful to believe that their child was actually dead, and they often cut ties with those children. Now, as that generation of adults is dying and our attitudes toward disability have changed, many siblings are discovering that they had a sibling with a disability placed in a large institution, and we are beginning to get requests from siblings desiring to reconnect with their family members. What this amendment does is helps the department establish a process that would facilitate that reconnection of family members. If it is something that is desirable to the family member. And so basically what the bill does is establish a right within the current statutes that would make it possible for someone to be informed that someone was seeking, a family member was seeking to connect with them. This does not violate HIPAA or other privacy regulations, but would just set up a process to facilitate that reconnection. And it's referred to as the Where's Molly bill because there is a specific family in Oregon who started this process and approached us about the legislation. It is not something that is unusual. We are hearing more and more from family members who are discovering that they did have a sibling and desire to reconnect.
Catherine, I'd like to recognize the Senate President, Senator P. Courtney, for bringing this forward. At least he brought it to my attention. Is that the case? Did Senator Courtney bring this forward?
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Courtney was approached by the family in this case.
Great. All right. Well, we appreciate that. We appreciate Senator Courtney for bringing the language forward, and thank you for putting it together. So that's the Dash 5, and we're ready to adopt that into this measure as well as the Dash 4, right? Is that right? Okay. Yes.
I just have one quick question. This is just if there's no survivors in the estate of the person who has died. Am I right? I'm just looking at these amendments now. back all the money the state has invested in this person?
Dash 4. Chairman Dalton and Representative Boone, I think that you're talking about the Dash 4 amendments again. And if you look at the back of the bill, and let me see if I can, the back of the amendments.
Which ones?
The Dash 4 amendments.
Okay.
Which now I'm not finding them. Hold on just a second. Sorry.
Is it page 8, line 18?
Thank you. That is changes the order in which the estates are recovered so that we can recover the clawback amount when there are those other conditions are not met. And it's once there are no surviving spouses left in the estate as well.
Okay. And they don't have another will.
I may need to defer this to...
Doesn't matter if they have a will.
Well, it doesn't matter if they have a will. It does not matter if they have a will. This is basically for, it's a payback to the states, to the state for the money that we've expended. And this just adds in the piece that we are now paying the federal government to what we currently do.
This isn't changing, as I understand, this isn't changing anything they do now. They go back into estates and get back money under general assistance. This is simply adding how that amount's calculated. It's added an amount that we're paying the federal government for their prescription coverage to the amount they now do. So it isn't changing the procedures for reclaiming money for a state. It's only changing the amount. Is that, Marie, that correct?
I would. That's a good way to characterize it, sir.
Can you answer one question for me, just very briefly? It's a question that I've always had floating in the back of my mind on estate recovery. So we have a general fund in the state that provides for long-term care services, that provides for health care services for this population, this aged population, and we have a mechanism through the estate recovery system which goes back and collects some of the monies that were paid out on the behalf of that individual when the estate when they process the estate and I guess liquidate the assets of the estate, and so the state recovers a portion of those charges. I don't understand why we pay into the general fund in the first place. I mean, we're paying taxes so that we can provide those services, and then we're trying to get the money back from the folks that we've paid out the services for, but we've already paid for the services. So are we collecting money so that we could put it back in the general fund for other people? I mean, like, what do we pay taxes for? That's kind of my question on that segment.
Chairman Dalto, the way I like to look at it is the way that we really fund long-term care. A portion of the estate recovery is almost like a loan to the individuals so that they have assets and resources available to them. We don't ask them to totally divest themselves of those resources before they need long-term care services or before they access Medicaid long-term care, but we do ask that they repay the state for those costs. And what we use the funds for is we bring those back into the Department of Human Services budget and offset meeting other general fund costs. So it's a cost savings to the state taxpayers so that we can then serve more people or continue to serve the people that we're serving. It's also a requirement in federal statute that we do a state recovery, and they get a portion of this money as well.
Because of the relationship with the Medicaid payment for some of the services.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, both of you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3108. We'll open a work session on 3108. I'd like motions separately on the Dash 4s and the Dash 5s, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to 3108.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3108. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? The Dash 4s are ordered adopted. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 5 amendment to 3108.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3108. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The Dash 5 amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Tomei, we're going to move this bill to the House Committee on Budget. So I'd like a motion to move the bill as amended to the House Committee on Budget, please.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3108 as amended to the House Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation as amended. with a DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk, we'll call the roll, please.
Representative
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Gibbons? Aye.
Representative
Campbell?
Votes aye.
Representative
Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative May?
Aye.
Chair
Dalto? Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3108, having received a constitutional majority, is referred to the House Budget Committee. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3108. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3428. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3428 was scheduled for Monday and got rescheduled for today. This is the bill that's requiring clinical laboratories to provide test results to patients within one business day after receiving the request from the patient for those results. This is changing current statute. From now, the requirement is 7 days.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. I was requested to have this bill drafted by one of my constituents, and I just wanted to read just a brief statement which pretty much tells why she has asked this bill to be drafted. And it says, Dear Representative Boone, I just learned that as of January 1st, 2004, there are changes to ORS 438-430 regarding patient access to laboratory results that require that I must wait at least 7 days after a written request to obtain a copy of the laboratory results. How absurd. These are my tests. I paid for them, and I have a right to have a copy immediately. And I shouldn't have to ask the doctor for prior written authorization for him for immediate release. This isn't looking out for the patient. It protects incompetent doctors and or misreading the results. Please fix this. Thank you. So I had the bill drafted and have since, and I think that was her reason, is she felt that if she had a lab test that she wanted to hear the results of as soon as possible, for whatever reason they were, she should have that right. Apparently, a doctor can get these results immediately. So she was thinking because she paid for them. And so I did, I drafted the bill. Subsequently, I've heard from a couple of people saying that one day is too soon. And I guess my question would be is, and I'm not wedded to the one day, but I'm guessing if it's okay for a doctor to ask for this result immediately and the doctor can get it, why can't the patient? So that's why I did it. And last year, apparently, the bill was changed to the no sooner, results could not be given out no sooner than 1 week or 7 days. So she's unable to be with me here today, and so I wouldn't entertain any questions. If you have any.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Boone, would there be a possibility there'd be situations in which the doctor might need to prepare himself to give the results to the patient? Say there was terminal cancer involved, that he sensed there was a real problem, and he wanted to be prepared to really discuss this with the patient and the family.
And I suppose that's a real possibility. That I would imagine that in that sense, the doctor could call the patient and say, I'd like to see you in person rather than give your results over the phone. I don't know.
But the results would go automatically here if he or she requested
them. I suppose they would.
Any follow-up?
Just a comment that maybe 7 days is too long, but 1 day is too short.
Any other questions?
A good comment.
Well, I have a comment. I suppose we could wait.
We want to wait until we get maybe all our testimony.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Catherine Otto and Scott Gallant.
I think I'm organized. think that.
I'm going to spread it on.
Go for it.
Good morning, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Otto. I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Clinical Laboratory Science. These are the members that perform, the people, the members of the profession, that perform clinical laboratory tests and manage clinical laboratories. We are in support of this bill, and we believe that it is an improvement to the current situation where the seven-day turnaround time, and we are very supportive of a patient having access to their laboratory tests. We do have one comment, though. We think that given that the seven-day turnaround time is administratively difficult, and we think for patients' purposes, we agree that the patient should have the right to have the information as soon as it's available. I'm making the suggestion now that we either eliminate this date restriction and just state that the patient has the right to their laboratory tests and we will get it to them. The other piece is the one-day turnaround time. If a patient comes to the laboratory and makes that request at the time we're collecting the sample, some tests take longer than 24 hours. So we wouldn't be in compliance with that portion. So we make the suggestion either eliminate the date or keep in the one business day and state that in addition of a requesting upon completion of the test, and I highlighted that in blue on the written testimony that I've given to you. As far as the information, as far that Representative Anderson made a comment about whether terminal cancer would be notified on a clinical laboratory test, I believe we're talking about things that are not tumors. That would be a tumor. What this is blood, body fluids. Hematology, in terms of leukemias, it does not state that it is a leukemia. It states that a differential portion tells you what kind of cells they are, and something that would say that it's a leukemic situation would just say blasts. The patient would just have that information to say, these are blasts there, and hopefully they would then phone their physician and ask, what does that mean? Laboratory test reports always have, for the physician or any clinician's sake, has a reference range for what is normal. It's often highlighted then in terms of that it's high or low to give the physician some extra help because there's all kinds of information. Many laboratory tests have interpretations also that a person can read. Given the fact that there's all kinds of internet information available, and there's some good and there's some bad, I gave you a website that lists a award-winning peer-reviewed laboratory information, lab tests online, and I don't get anything for this. I'm just suggesting that this is one site that is available, that patients have that access, and they have some information, and this can support that along with funding their physician. So in summary, we believe this will be an improvement to the current situation, and we are happily supporting. I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Would it be possible to detect HIV by a blood test?
HIV test, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, HIV testing is...
Couldn't that fit into the category?
It does fit in that, but it has separate requirements for reporting, so I believe that it has a higher standard. It would supersede this.
Okay.
Representative Greenlick?
Yes, I would like to check just a moment on this statement you made in your definition of a lab, although I have a different perspective than Dr. Anderson has. I do want to ask the question, is it your perception that this definition of clinical lab does not include reporting on past specimens?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, pathology.
Pathology. Specimen. That's my understanding.
So that under the definition, you're examining specimens, and it says, I'm just trying to find, of any test examination or analysis of the specimen submitted by the patient, a clinical laboratory. Maybe Mike can comment on that. I mean, histology would be included in this, and that cancer test would be a part of it.
Thank you, Scott. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I can wait, Todd. We'll wait.
after he's done. Yeah.
Okay.
He's already spoken. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I think I'm here to confuse matters for you a little bit more, and I apologize.
Could they be different than any other?
Why, thank you, Representative Greenland. The association supports the idea of patients having appropriate access to lab tests, but we believe that the bill as it is drafted raises a number of concerns and is in fact inconsistent with HIPAA, even though I know you've received previous testimony from another organization of what those standards are. HIPAA actually provides for 30 days if the test is done on site, an additional 30 days if it's done out of state, and this bill doesn't address that. But nevertheless, the original bill, the statute that, as it exists today, was in fact a bill that we worked on at one point opposing. I apologize, my testimony indicates that we opposed the legislation all the way through. We did not. We did work out the language in this compromise in order to enable a couple of things to happen. One was, it seems appropriate that the attending physician receive the lab results at least at the same time the patient does, if not sooner, so that at least the physician is aware of what is going on with his or her patient. This bill is drafted in a way that one could surmise that a patient could receive the test, look at it, and as you have now discovered, it could be very serious medical conditions, and the physician might not have had the time nor receive the lab tests himself or herself, which I think is a problem. Secondly, the penalty for failure under this bill is a criminal penalty, which brings a prison term, potential prison term, up to a year or jail time, up to a year, or an over $6,000 fine, as the law currently exists, according to my counsel. I know that you don't see it there, but that's the way the statutes work. So you need to appreciate that. I mean, this is a very serious sort of thing, in our opinion. What we thought would be more realistic, and we provided a draft proposal that would enable a patient to receive a test earlier, you know, first day, second day, or whatever, or within the ability of the lab to produce the test within the time frames outlined in HIPAA. Now, it's a fairly extensive amendment, and I won't go through it, but I don't believe that this change is as simple as one might believe, nor that it might not have very significant implications for some patients where there are very serious medical conditions. There are such things as false positives, as any lab will tell you, and often physicians will request subsequent tests because they suspect there may be a false positive, and a patient could very easily be misguided in their original result from the lab test. So I would encourage the committee to tread carefully on going down this path before you really think through all of the nuances of what it might mean for both patients, physicians, and labs, where there's a request, you know, one-day business request that can't be done physically or appropriately. It does not make exceptions, as HIPAA does, where the life and safety of an individual is involved. That's not considered in this proposal. While we would agree patient access to the lab tests, which are available by requesting medical records, by the way, is a very serious concern. and one that you have to be cautious with. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Representative Cameron?
Not right now.
Representative Greenwich, sure.
Yeah, I'm intrigued with your exotic interpretation of the law by your attorney. I don't like to argue with it. This is an amendment to 438-430, which essentially prohibits the disclosure to anybody but a physician or the patient. I suspect your attorney, you can tell me, is saying that it's a felony to...
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlink, it's a Class A misdemeanor, and the penalty carries...
Class A misdemeanor to divulge the result to anybody except under sub 2. And it's your attorney's position that violating the time in sub 2B under the current law, the 7-day law, is a Class A misdemeanor?
Madam, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, my counsel has never been called exotic.
I didn't know. Exotic
or exotic interpretation. Yeah. Our counsel's interpretation is, as this bill is currently written, the current statute says that those tests would be available in no less than, I think it's no less than 7 days. But to answer your question, yes, their interpretation is, as this is written, if the patient requested it, either verbally or otherwise, and the lab test was not forthcoming, they could be exposed to a Class A misdemeanor.
May I continue, sir? Whoever's in charge, whoever's got the gravel down there? Okay. All it changes is 7 days to 1 day. So currently, under that interpretation, any clinical laboratory that didn't make the 7-day deadline would be subject to conviction of a Class A misdemeanor. Do you have any evidence that anybody has ever been convicted of a Class A misdemeanor for being 8 days instead of 7 days?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, actually the statute says not sooner than 7 days,
okay,
which means that a lab would be able to provide the patient a lab test any time after the 7-day period. And I think it would be very difficult.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Has there ever been anybody convicted of a Class A misdemeanor for violating, however it reads, the section that's being amended here, sub 3B in 438-430?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, I was getting to your question.
I have an answer when you get to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Would you like me to do that?
I'd love it.
Thank you. It's great. It's Friday. The statute says not sooner than 7 days, which means the lab could provide the test any time thereafter. Therefore, I suspect there has not been a penalty under this particular provision of law, because there is the flexibility for the lab to have the test, the physician to have the test, and for them to be able to get it to the patient. As the statute is proposed to be changed, it literally says one business day on request, and I believe that some creative attorney could very easily seek a penalty under this provision, and it would be put, I think, a lot of labs and potentially a lot of physicians, who, by the way, do some lab tests in their offices, to exposure of a criminal penalty and fine. That is my point.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm not sure whether this question goes to Ms. Otto or to Mr. Galland, but aren't there some cultures and lab work would take several days? And what's the nature of that under this proposal?
That's, Chairman Balto, Representative Butler, that is one of the concerns with the one-day request, that we make a recommendation that either eliminate the time frame or say upon completion of the test.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's probably for Catherine or Scott if you want to answer in on this. I see all kinds of problems with this bill. The details of making this happen, obviously one that Representative Butler just said about the timing and the confusion of how long a test takes. There's not rules that laid out in here. How do I request the test? Is it via phone call? Is it in writing? How do I know it got received? How is a lab in one day going to get information back to me? Is it FedEx? Is it fax? I mean, it's not laid out. Can you answer some of the details of the bill?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Cameron, that is true. In terms of the details are not laid out, and I guess to some people would expect they wouldn't be codified into law here. Each laboratory would say, make up their own requirements in terms of if it needed to be verbally or in writing, and I would think they would request it to be in writing for their own documentation purposes. And then, you're right, it doesn't say when. We envision the idea that you get this information whenever the test is completed, that it would be mailed. But, you know, if that requires that you have something specific, I can see that you could do that, or you could leave that up to administrative rules.
Representative Cameron,
if there's a Class C felony attached to it, I don't want to leave it up to rules.
Representative Boone.
And I should say that I suppose, and I'm not placing any blame on counsel or anything, but the requester was adamant that it be immediately, and maybe perhaps what we should have requested, and before it was drafted, to say as soon as possible or something like that. I mean, I agree with you. One day may not work, and in particular, for unless they were going to phone it in or email or something that could be immediate, notwithstanding the mail. But I understand that some tests do take longer, and I think her frustration was with the not sooner than 7 days part. If it could have been directed sooner, that's my guess, my sense of it. And if it goes any further, I'm sorry, Scott. Excuse me.
I was going to try to respond.
I'm very open to making those necessary changes.
Right. And what we have suggested would enable you to do that. The idea of the legislation from last session was to enable the labs to produce the test, get it to the appropriate physician, and enable the patient, obviously, to either receive the test results from the physician, which, by the way, is our preference, but nevertheless, and to the patient if the patient so chose. There are, again, I just can't emphasize this enough, there are instances where a patient could easily be misled, in some instances, rare as they may be, where you have false positives. And I just think you have to be very cautious on how you work through this, given that the lab test definition, or lack thereof, is exceedingly broad.
Okay, all right, we're done. Thanks very
much.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3428. We're going to do a little business here very quickly. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2325, the Task Force on the State Hospital. We'll close the public hearing on 2325. We're going to open a public hearing on 2765, which is the Task Force on DHS Organization. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2765. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3086, which is the Community-Based Delivery for Services, Human Services. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3086. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3160, which is Department of Human Services, close the public hearing on House Bill 5160. Colleagues, we'll get back to the agenda, from the top, and then just work our way down from there. So with that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 3422. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3422, we heard about it on Wednesday. We had amendments at that time that needed to be modified. The bill is brought forward by Representative Boone. Paul directs the Department of Human Services to establish a pilot program with mental health organizations that provide mental health services in rural communities to pursue creating a local pool of federal, state, local, and private funds to procure more resources. It has a sunset date. The amendment at that, we remove language from the dash one. I apologize, what you have behind your staff measure summary is the dash two. That dash two on 3422 dated 5505. We now have a dash three, but you do not have copies of it. If it is the desire of the committee, we have some conceptual amendment language. So if you would look at your dash two amendment, line 12 and 13, the current language says the department shall seek necessary federal approval of the proposal for the pilot program. That language is not necessarily adequate for the department. The department generally does not submit an entire proposal for federal approval, so we have new language that will read this way: the department shall seek any federal approval necessary to implement the proposal for the pilot program. The department is okay with that language. Ralph is here to answer any technical questions on the balance of the amendment if the committee so desires. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Do we have a sign-up sheet?
No, it's just a work session, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Boone, are we ready to go?
I think so.
Okay. Can you walk us through the process?
I was under the impression that was the language that was agreed upon, but if that's what it takes. So do we need to help me with my procedure here?
Can we stand here for a moment?
Yeah. Could another amendment come out of Ways and Means?
This meeting back to order. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 3422. Representative Boone, would you kindly visit with the department in the next few minutes, please?
Mm-hmm.
Would you get some information that is responsive to Representative Greenlich's concern? And can you let me know when this bill is ready to go? Thank you very much.
I think it's ready now.
Do you want to come out if I'm not?
Okay. We will open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 25. Find the last one here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Can you remind us where we are on HJR 25?
HJR 25, as you recall, has already had a hearing. It is basically a resolution that deals with direct care staff that work in residential homes, actually in a number of settings. But I represent both DD and MED clients. These folks are the folks that obviously do the direct care work with these clients. In many cases, and in most cases, haven't had raises in years, work for minimum wage. In Ways and Means, yesterday there was discussion about the, because they are so low paying, the turnover rate ranges in the state between 50 and 60%. So this was an effort by a number of folks to at least recognize them in the state, the job that they do, very hard job, and the competition that there is for their services to go out and work in other settings, and those that stick with it, it's just recognition, and we all recognize that, but a lot of times it's nice to have somebody say, we appreciate what it is you do.
Excellent. I agree. Are there any amendments that are necessary to this?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian.
committee for...
Yeah, we need to close the public hearing and open the work session. So we'll close the public hearing on HJR 25, open work session on HJR 25. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 25 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves HJR 25 be adopted with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Let me get the rest of that to
the floor. Okay. Any objection? Yeah. Pamela, will you run out there and yell vote? Well, I'm turning on the timer. You'll be off the floor here in a minute. Just one moment. Clerk will call the roll on HJR 25, please.
Yes.
President
Boone?
Yes.
President
Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenlich?
Aye.
President
Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Dolto? Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Joint Resolution 25, having received a constitutional majority, is adopted. Chair will carry this bill. Close the work session on House Joint Resolution 25. Let's see where's my agenda. I don't want to lost my agenda. Yes. Representative Greenlich, we're ready to go on another bill.
Yep.
We'll reopen the work session of House Bill 3422. Representative Greenlich, where are we?
The concern wasn't on... I need to find the bill. 3422. Can I borrow some? Oh, I got it. It's reminding of the closing days, right? The problem in the dash two amendments that was causing a little concern to the department wasn't the question of any. It was the question that they would like to be clear that we're talking about they can seek approval in whatever form it makes. That we're not requiring by statute a 1,000-page proposal in order for them to submit it. The federal government might require that, but that's a whole separate problem. So it's just important to put on the record. I think this wording is fine. To put on the record that if a proposal is a one-page letter saying here's what our proposal is, and that's okay with the federal government or anybody else, that's certainly okay under the statute, and that intent is there. And I think they're satisfied with that.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, we can move the dash twos as they're written and put on the record that the legislative intent is do what you need to do. Okay, all right. Thank you very much, Representative Greenlich. Representative Greenlich, can I have a motion, please?
I move the dash two amendments be entered into HB 3422.
Thank you, Representative Greenlich. Representative Greenlich moves dash two amendments to House Bill 3422. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Dash two amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Greenlich?
I move House Bill 3422. Is there a subsequent?
Yeah, the House Budget Committee.
To the House, with a subsequent referral to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Greenlich. Representative Greenlich moves House Bill 3422 as amended to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Call the roll.
President
Anderson?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenlight?
Aye.
President Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Dalton? Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3422, having received a constitutional majority, is ordered to the House Committee on Budget. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3422. We will open a work session on House Bill 2362. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2362 is creating a task force to study the coordination of services and create an integrated funding system for services to children with severe emotional and mental disorders. The task force has a sunset date at the first day of the next legislative assembly. Declares an emergency. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have no amendments on this bill.
Is that right? I thought there was a dash one amendment on this.
2362. I apologize, Mr. Chair. If there is a dash one, I have not received a copy of it.
Can you just take them off what they say as amended?
We'll scan these from. To order, we will recess the public hearing or the work session on House Bill 2362. Yeah, there is a dash one. Representative Greenlee, are you ready on your drug policy? Are you ready on the drug policy coordinator?
Sure.
Okay. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2955.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2955 directs the governor to appoint a drug policy coordinator. You have a dash one amendment dated 5-2-2005. It adds additional, it expands the group of folks that the coordinator shall meet with. It is to include local mental health authorities that are conducting local activities and initiatives relating to substance abuse treatment and prevention programs. This has a subsequently filled Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee, where are we on this bill?
The main question we had was there were two main questions. One is how would it fit into the governor's staff. The other was to make sure that it related to the counties and the local authorities that were involved. We have an amendment to do that. The staff has not submitted a fiscal on it yet. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that I assume is still in force, which would allow any discussion of a fiscal. So my recommendation is that we move it to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
See if it ends up with a fiscal. It doesn't necessarily need a fiscal. Governor's staff could agree to organize, and the governor could agree to organize the staff this way, and it wouldn't require a fiscal.
Okay. I think this is a good bill. It sounds to me like it's ready to go, so we'll accept the motion, Representative Greenlee.
I move the dash one, I believe, amendment to House Bill 2955. Yes, the dash one.
Representative Greenlee moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2955. Cause, do you have the dash one amendments?
You should have a hand engrossed in a dash one amendment behind your SMS.
Here's an extra. You need the dash one.
I believe. Is anybody not happy?
Okay. All right. Is there any discussion on the dash one amendments? Is there any objection to the dash one amendments? Seeing no objection, the dash one amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Greenlee.
I move HB 2955 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Greenlee.
As amended, I'm sorry.
Right. Representative Greenlee moves House Bill 2955 as amended to the House Budget Committee. Is there any, with a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
President Boone.
Aye.
President Cameron.
Aye.
President Greenwood.
Aye.
President Fame.
Aye.
President Butler.
Aye.
Chair Dalto.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2955, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. The bill is referred to the House Budget Committee. Committee will stand at ease for a moment.
Can I ask a question?
Off the record.
Representative Butler was excused from 3 votes. I'd like a motion, please, to suspend the rules and allow Representative Butler to vote on House Bill 3108, HJR 25, and 3422.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves to suspend the rules and to allow House Representative Butler to vote on House Bill 3108, HJR 25, and House Bill 3422. Representative Butler, how do you vote on House Bill 3108?
Butler votes aye.
Butler votes aye. Representative Butler, how do you vote on HJR 25?
HJR 25, Butler votes aye.
Butler votes aye. And Representative Butler, how do you vote on House Bill 3422?
Butler votes aye.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Okay. We will open a work session on House Bill 2276. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2276, we had a public hearing on March 21st. As you recall, this is the bill that is making some modifications to the Oregon Supplemental Income Program. The It's in the Department of Human Services. We have received the Welfare Code Workgroup Report that was facilitated by the Oregon Law Commission. At that time, they had some dash one amendments. Those amendments have been modified and made some changes with the dash twos that should be behind your SMS. There is no hand in gross. This bill in its original form had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have gotten authority from the Speaker to rescind that Ways and Means referral, and we have staff from the Law Commission here to walk you through the dash two amendments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Wendy Johnson.
The dash two supplement or replace the dash one?
The replace the dash.
Wendy, welcome. Where are we at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. The dash two amendments are identical to the dash one amendments, with the exception of a very minor provision. It's on page 2, in line 22, after program, delete the rest of the line, and line 23, and insert shall. The issue on this bill was that the summary of the bill suggests that the bill creates the Oregon Supplemental Income Program. And as many of you know, that program has been around since the 70s, so the bill doesn't actually create it, but it does codify what it is called, which is the Oregon Supplemental Income Program. The chapters presently refer to aid to the blind, aid to the disabled, and old age assistance. But in actuality, the program is OSIP. And so so that the summary can be changed and it doesn't appear that the legislature is creating a new program, the word create is deleted and the word shall is inserted. Then when this bill is engrossed, the creates language would also be removed from the summary.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I had some objections to the original form. I'm satisfied with where this is going in this one.
Thank you, Representative Greenwich. Okay. Wendy, thanks.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to confirm that this is still, the OSIP is still within the DHS, and the resources, which are federal resources, I think it was $1.70 per recipient per month, still would be received and expended in the same fashion.
Wendy, is that a question you can answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, the program hasn't changed at all. It just actually calls it what it is. But when you look in the rules, it is the $1.70 for most of the folks, except for the blind. It's the $20.70. It is required to keep that small supplemental payment to keep Medicaid payments.
Thank you. I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we're not affecting supplemental payments by any action we would take with the plan.
All right. We're in work session. I'd like a motion on the dash two amendments, please.
Sure. I move the dash two amendments be appended to House Bill 2276, voted 428-05.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2276. Any discussion? Any objection? See no objection. The dash two amendments are ordered adopted. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2276 as dash two amended. I understand that we have no further need to refer it to Ways and Means by prior reference. That it be, as amended, be moved to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2276 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the clerk will call the roll.
President
Anderson? Aye.
President
Boone? Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenwood?
Aye.
President
Tomei?
Aye.
President Butler?
Butler votes aye.
Chair Volta?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2276, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. I think this is one for the consent calendar. I'd like a motion, please.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2276 be placed on a consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, House Bill 2276 is ordered placed on a consent calendar. We will close the work session on House Bill 2276. We will open a public hearing on House Memorial 8. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. You will recall in March we received a presentation from the law enforcement leaders, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, and the state director of the Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon. At that time, they gave a presentation and spoke to the current rise of crime and the proposed federal withdrawal of the foster care funding pledge. At that point, Representative Anderson met with representatives of the organization, and we introduced as a committee Memorial HM8. That is before us, before the committee, to take action. We have no public testimony, but I believe I attached, as a reminder to you, the executive summary and background from the report that Martha Brooks, the state director of Investing Kids, presented to us in March. And Representative Anderson may want to speak to the work group's efforts on the memorial.
Representative Anderson, could you tell us a little bit about the process that you undertook to bring this memorial to us?
It was a very simple process. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We just met once, put the all of the wording in place. I then rewrote it a little bit, checked with them, brought it back to you, and this is what you see today.
Okay. Colleagues, I don't intend to move this bill today, so I don't have anybody on the sign-up sheet that signed up to give public testimony. Is anybody in the audience that was here for House Memorial 8? Seeing nobody, we will go ahead.
Discussion?
Well, we're not going to move the bill, so did you have something to say before we close the public hearing?
Yes, I think I'm very much in favor of the memorial. I think that there are a number of things that we need to look at, as you and I have talked about, Mr. Chair, that relate not to the funds, but to the procedures that the department is often using with the foster parents. And I think we need to really look at and eventually encourage, maybe make recommendations, suggestions to the department in making it more facile for people to be foster parents. Doesn't relate to this memorial direction.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Colleagues, to sort of let you know what I'm thinking on HJM 8, we heard a compelling presentation by the proponents of the bill, Fight Crime, Invest in Kids of Oregon. The problem that I see at this point is that the contents of this memorial sort of contravene the direction of the administration on the national level in where they're headed in foster care. And I think, for one, I would like to spend a little bit more time thinking about the national level direction and how it relates to Oregon compared to what we do. And we've been spending a lot of time on child welfare and child protective issues, but we haven't spent enough time yet on foster care. And so Representative Anderson and I are going to start delving into that shortly and see how that fits in the context of this memorial. And so when we have sort of resolution in our minds, then we will decide what action we're going to take on House Memorial 8. So that's kind of what the chair is thinking. Does anybody have any comments?
Is this under the auspice also of the subcommittee, child welfare? Will we be dealing with foster care in that subcommittee?
Well, you know, the challenge, as I see it, Representative Greenlich, is that we have a limited amount of time in this legislative session to take up the issue. And foster care is an issue sort of unto itself that we could spend a great deal of time in a deliberative fashion trying to improve that system. And right now our efforts are focused on the child protective services side and the department and some systems issues related to how the department provides those protective services, and that's taken up quite a bit of our bandwidth. So I think that's kind of where we are right now. All right, seeing no further discussion on House Memorial 8, we will close the public hearing on House Memorial 8. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3424. Yes, Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3424 is requiring that long-term care facilities serve meals that address nutritional needs of the residents. You have attached to your SMS a comprehensive packet of information from the Oregon Healthcare Association that gives you a number of different data and regulatory, federal regulatory instructions that address nutritional needs in long-term care facilities. And we have nobody signed.
Okay, thank you, Sandy. Representative Boone, would you like to introduce us to the bill, please?
Yes. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I bring this bill to you today as something to try to help our senior citizens and those in long-term care facilities have a little more enjoyment in their day and perhaps become a little healthier, remain a little healthier as a result of it. Currently, although there are in the large attachment that the chair referred to, requirements for nutrition, therefore medical, or for diets shall be prescribed by the attending physician, and therapeutic menus prepared and served as ordered. They're never defined, and I have talked with quite a few people who have either family members or friends in some of these facilities, as well as some of the people who work there. And a lot of this sort of thing comes down to the bottom line in the operation of the facility. And one of the top service priority levels for considering people for services is eating. And although this says, it basically says individuals with limitations in this category cannot feed themselves, cannot be left alone due to possibility of choking, or they need constant encouragement to eat. And if you need constant encouragement to eat, it means either you have no appetite or what is offered to you is not appetizing to you, and therefore you choose not to eat it. If we can do anything for our friends in these facilities in a reasonable way and consider it part of their well-being, medical treatment, whatever have you, one of the most basic things we can do is food, good food, good nutritious food. And I happen to believe, and I am not a physician, but I happen to believe, and I've had a parent in a situation like this, my father, who was a good eater, and he loved to eat, he loved food, but when he was in his last 2 weeks of his life, and that wasn't because he was in declining physical health, that way he had other things going on, but he could eat, and he could eat when he came in, and he could barely eat when at the very end, because the food was atrocious. And it was, I looked at it, I ate lunches with him there, and the food was, I could tell, the lowest common denominator is the best description of what it was. And it was repetitive and repetitive, repetitive. And I think that's a hard thing when you're in a situation like that where there's really not a lot to do all day, and maybe one of the high points or the high point of your day are the meals. And to have three meals that are nutritious and two snacks that are good food, good for you, maybe it's going to eliminate some of the need for some of the medication by being healthier, and particularly if nutrition causes you to maintain your health better. So there is an amendment to this bill, the Dash Ones, which basically define the balanced meal, nutritionally balanced meals as fresh fruit and vegetables in season, and snacks, and the nutritionally balanced meals. And I have to back up just a hair. I still don't hear any evidence of doctors in their training having much in the line of nutritional training. And we all know a lot about nutrition these days. And there's just been a new food pyramid come out. And we're all concerned with our health, and we try to eat healthy, and we even have our up in our...
Go ahead, Representative.
The new food group, Are Twinkies still on top, or where do they fall on that news for you?
I have bad news for you, Rep.
Coffee, coffee's on top, and then followed by peanut butter and chocolate.
The four food groups have drastically changed in the last 2 weeks.
Twinkies aren't at the top?
Twinkies are no longer on top.
Oh, my goodness.
They're, well, actually on top, because that's the smallest amount that you want to have.
Well, that's
maybe
my basic combination.
I think they fell off, but in any case... But I guess my, and I'd like to address one issue, and I'll just read this section I got from someone who provided this information for me, who's in this business. So the vendor-issued menu programs are an excellent guide for the cook who has limited skills in menu writing, and it allows for a lesser experienced food prep person to prepare meals. So the big companies that sell prepared foods and process prepared foods, that purpose for just getting the food out, that's working like that. That's what it does. It gets the food to the person. None of this equates to nutritional quality meals that meet the individual needs of residents. This type of food program is devised to sell food products handled specifically by the food vendor, and the menus are designed to feed the resident within the budget requested by the facility purchasing the menu program. The nutritional information is secondary byproduct of the menu plan, which allows for compliance to state standards. So, in a nutshell, it means you have X number of dollars per day to feed people, and whatever fits into that, that meets those needs, that it's all about money in the end. It's all about money. And I just think that, in particular with the costs of what we're spending on long-term care, when people are in there $2,000-$3,000 a month on the high end, and maybe that is the middle high end anymore, but even $1,200 and $1,500 on the low end, the least we could do for these people is give them good nutrition and tasty food, and food that's good that we would want to eat. And I guess that's all I have to say.
Jim Cameron?
Representative Boone, I'm looking at these, the federal guidelines already lay that out, don't they? What's it?
They don't define nutrition. They
don't define nutrition?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't define, I didn't get into defining it. Nutritionally balanced meals that meet the nutritional needs of the residents as identified in the residents' care plan. In the original bill, it states that it would require long-term care facilities to serve meals that address nutritional needs of the residents. This is another case of interpretation down the hall. But when I originally put in the request for this bill, I said to make nutrition a part of the medical treatment plan for each resident, which would then provide nutritional balanced meals and snacks.
Even, and I'm just looking at the federal, and it says within a certain amount of days, if I remember right, each patient needs to have a plan. I'm just concerned that we're making a law on top of something that already exists on federal guidelines that we should be following. Thank you.
I regularly taste, I mean, I've spent a lot of money
at
fancy restaurants and it tastes awful sometimes. I'm not talking about cafe today. I'm talking about pop culture. You know.
I guess, Chair Dalton.
Cafe Day's breakfast is excellent.
Consistently yes. And we're very lucky to have the chef we do upstairs, who does do a lot of research and takes a lot of care with the nutritionally balanced meals that she serves and foods that she provides. And I guess the best way to find out is to visit some of these places and see what the menu sound great. If you get a copy of the menu where it says fluffy Belgian waffle with a da 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 da, it's an eggo. It's an eggo, one eggo. And meal substitutions can be simple as that. But I don't think I've ever heard, and I'm not just saying my father, I know several older people who've been in this situation, and when it's as a cliche, the same it is as airplane food, which has improved, or hospital food, which has also improved. I think that it's kind of an acceptable comment to say that assisted living food is not always the most nutritious, as in any institutional food.
Like, if people are going to complain about anything, though, I mean, at some point, even if the food is nutritious and, you know, served to these federal guidelines, I mean, I kept complaining that my coffee downstairs, you know, wasn't tasting the way I wanted it to taste it. And finally it changed and got better, but...
It's your adult that we changed it, now everybody else is complaining.
Well, I guess I might have to throw in the piece about, and I love Ronald Reagan, but when he declared ketchup a vegetable, I think that's a clue.
All right, Representative Greenlake, your
thank
comment.
You, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Mitch Greenlake, House District 33, one of the co-sponsors on this bill. I've been working in geriatrics and in long-term care for about 40 years now, and I thought this is an appropriate symbolic bill. The current statute requires three meals a day, but it doesn't define the three meals a day. What's important, particularly in the Dash 1 amendment, is that it links the nutritional needs to the care plan, and I was stimulated to be interested in this with a recent experience with a cousin of mine who, after surgery in the hospital, ended up in a care facility. And my relative is a diabetic with training as a chef, and I ended up getting a running commentary. My relative amused herself by critiquing the meals. But what was very clear to me is that the folks in these institutions work very, very hard. They do an amazing job. They do an amazing job under difficult circumstances, and they really work hard to care for their patients. But the complexity of making sure that the meals relate to the care plan in people that have nutritional requirements is a very special problem, and I think it's very important for us to highlight it. By actual count, two of the three meals she was served on average in a day were not appropriate for a diabetic taking insulin. And they were very nice, and she would get a tray, and she would look at the tray, and it would have a cup of white rice, and it would have a piece of apple pie, and it would have a piece of something. She would say, okay, now here's what you have to do. You have to take this meal back, and you have to take the rice off it, and you have to take the fruit off it and give me a low sugar Jell-O that you have in the kitchen. It's right up there in the refrigerator on the upper left-hand side. And, it just struck me as being a real problem, because a diabetic in there for surgery relating to circulatory problems around diabetes needs to have a nutritionally well-balanced meal that relates to the care plan. And putting this into statute is not going to change the world, and it's not going to make people in an institution happy with their meals. They're going to hate their meals anyway, because I think that's right. I think if you spent three meals a day for 30 days in a Waldorf Astoria, you'd be bitterly complaining about the foie gras, even if you didn't care about geese. But, it just seems to me that I think it is important for us to symbolically link these nutritionally well-balanced meals to a care plan and to have a little specificity in it. And I think it's a modest contribution. I don't think it's going to change the world, but I think it's worth moving in this direction. And thank you for hearing this, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
It's been my pleasure. Representative Cameron?
I just want to clarify, because when I look at these rules, it says we have to have a trained dietitian. We have to have... we're not talking chef here. We're talking about somebody who understands diet needs. And being one who's been involved in food service, there's always a balance between what tastes good and what's good for you. And we all can relate to that when we go upstairs and eat our meals. And so I've heard a couple different things here about whether it tastes good versus what it's good for you. And when I look at these federal guidelines, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in here that lays out that the dietary needs need to be planned out and those kinds of things. So I want to be cautious in putting something in law that says we need to have healthy food and good food, and how do you measure that? So,
well, there isn't anything in here that talks about taste. I mean, basically, we're talking about nutritionally balanced meals that meet the nutritional needs as identified in the residence care plan. I mean, this isn't talking about gourmet, and it's talking about anything else. It's simply talking about that. And while there are federal and state requirements that there be a trained dietitian overall responsible for it, where the failure comes is in the implementation of that. I mean, what happens is the dietitian comes in, writes a careful care plan out, the care plan goes into the record somewhere, and then rice and apple pie shows up in a diabetic's tray. And these are very difficult institutions to manage. I mean, I really have enormous empathy. I mean, they're even harder to manage than a regular restaurant. But we do have regulations in the state statutes, and they're shown in the statute. And this simply adds, I think, an important piece to those regulations.
You said you wanted amendments.
Yeah, this isn't blasting. You hear a lot of complaints from nursing home operators how they get blasted on a federal inspection for having the toilet paper rolls turned the wrong way and things like that. I think that's not what we're doing.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we done?
Thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair.
On House Bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Anderson, you had a comment.
I just had one comment.
Yes.
I really appreciate the intent with which this bill was brought to us. You know, if you disagree with the taste or the nutrition of a restaurant, you tend not to go back. And while I appreciate that many of the seniors are in a place where they don't have family and they have no representation, those who do, like Representative Greenlake here, there's a market out there. And I think we need to be careful about legislating everything right down to the nutrition. That has been designated by the feds. But taste and how you carry out those daily requirements is a different story. I have a sense that this bill is going to end up in a report on the shelf of the all the nursing homes, and they're going to go on doing what they do, unless family and friends come in and say, you know, I ate this meal with my relative. It really lacks. It's a carbohydrate-heavy meal for a diabetic. That's inappropriate. You need to be more careful. And let the market work. If people continually are complaining, they're either going to move their relatives and friends out or there's going to be some changes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Sorry about missing you there. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3424 and open a public hearing on H.J.R. 6. This is the bill that proposes a constitutional amendment to declare health care as a fundamental right. We will close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 6. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2496. Colleagues, this bill, in its present form, relates to smoking. We are going to replace this bill with language that is specific to the Oregon Health Policy Commission. The Health Policy Commission had an issue come up in the course of the work of this new commission, which Representative Greenlake and I are members on that commission. They need an opportunity to stagger their terms so that everybody doesn't come off a commission and have to be replaced at the same time. So this was identified as a vehicle that would work because the bill refers to public health. So I'd like to invite Gretchen Morley, the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, forward to explain her Dash 2 amendments.
Still with us, are you?
You should have Dash 2 amendments in your packet.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to explain this amendment to you. As Chair Dalto, for the record, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. As Representative Dalto explained, we're in a position at this point where we potentially could have a time when all of the commission members, or a good portion of them, change at the same time. Just to give you a sense of what the changes would be, currently the Health Policy Commission legislation specifies that members can serve no more than 2 3-year terms. And then if there is a vacancy halfway through a term, the person who's appointed to the committee fills out the unexpired term. So there's really no way at this point to get off of a very straight 3-year schedule for pretty much everybody on the committee, on the commission. So what the amendments would do, and actually also to point out, 9 of the 10 commission members were appointed on the exact same date, so there really is no variation there. The amendments would do two things and give us two opportunities to stagger terms. One, it would take the opportunity, the first 3 new appointments that the governor makes to the commission, so this would be in the case of a commission member not going on to a second 3-year term, would be appointed for a 4-year term, just to put in there a staggering for those 3 people. After, if they were to actually serve a second term, they would go back to the 3-year term, so we have some simplicity down the road that people are still serving 3-year terms across the board. The second change that the bill would make is that it would change the midterm vacancy provision that I just described. If we have a vacancy halfway through a term, when we appoint a new member, it would start a new 3-year term. So then it provides another opportunity to get off of the straight 3-year window of everybody. So, and then we would also appreciate, obviously, having it effective immediately on passage, because that would permit us to start implementing those provisions as we do have vacancies.
No.
So I think that's all I would say about that, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody may have.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thanks, Gretchen. Colleagues, it was an oversight that we didn't have a possible work session scheduled on this bill today, so unfortunately we'll have to bring this back to be able to move the language and move the bill out to the floor for consideration so we can repair that situation for the Oregon Health Policy Commission. So we'll get the measure back at our first opportunity and move the dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Green.
Just a brief comment. I obviously support this, but I do want to note a certain sadness on the fact that we're replacing a bill that I think is very important to the public health of the state, and that's a bill to deal with secondhand smoke in places of employment. So I just want to put on the record that I'd much rather have the original bill, but I obviously support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Tomato, do you have comments?
Thank you. You're reading my mind. If Representative Mitch Greenlee hadn't spoken up, I certainly would. I feel great disappointed. I think if we had done only one thing in this whole legislative session to help the people of Oregon, especially the children of Oregon, that if we could have passed this bill prohibiting smoking in workplace, I think we would have done a phenomenal job. So I also am very disappointed that we are gutting and stuffing that bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Turner, for your comments. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2496. And the committee will stand at ease for just a brief moment. Committee back to order. Apologize for all the at-eases here, colleagues. There's a lot of stuff on the agenda, and with this many items, sometimes hard to figure things out as we go along. So we're going to go back to House Bill 2362 and open a work session on House Bill 2362. Colleagues, you'll recall that this is a bill that creates a task force to study the coordination and integration of the Children's Mental Health Initiative. And we have dash 1 amendments, which you have had passed out a short while ago. The dash 1 amendments change the bill from a task force to an interim committee, which is basically allowing the legislature to take a more direct role and further refine the composition of members of that interim committee. And so that's what we're going to pass out. The bill has to go to a budget committee. And so what I'd like to do in this work session is to move the dash 1 amendments, and then we will move the bill as amended to the House Committee on Budget. So may I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair, before we do that, could
yes.
we talk some about the amendments briefly? I know you're in a rush.
Sure.
But it says that line 11, delete 20. I don't see what's in line 11. The original bill.
Page 2?
Oh,
line 11.
Okay, thank you, Sandy. I didn't read that part.
So is that fewer members? Is that what that does? So it'll only be 4 members? Is that correct?
It,
go ahead.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
How about that?
Yes, it looks like it's going from the task force of 20 to an interim committee of 4 members.
And do we know why that is?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I've had input from some of the folks. I think you have a letter here from CHARP. Number one, I think they were afraid that there'd be a fiscal that would knock out the interim committee.
Okay.
Or the task force. And they felt that by doing it during the interim with a legislative committee, that they could much better accomplish the planning and infrastructure that they'd like to bring before the legislature next time.
So this would take it out of the...
It would take it out of the way.
Okay, I see.
We still have the referral, but it's minimizing the fiscal impact and increasing the likelihood that that this measure would become law. Does that satisfy your concern?
Well, it does. It's just 4 is a really hard number because that means that 3 of the 4 would have to be there to have a quorum. But 5, if you have 5, would be the same thing. So, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So a motion on dash 1, please.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 1 amendments to 2362.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Boone moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2362. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the dash 1 amendments are ordered as adopted. Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2362 as amended to the floor with the two ways and means with the due pass.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2362 as amended to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, does it have to go to that committee if it's only a legislative committee?
The bill has a prior... referral, and we do not have clearance to remove the referral.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll, please.
President Anderson?
Aye.
President Boone?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenwood?
Aye.
President Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Dalto?
Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 2362, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed and referred to the Committee on Budget. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2362 and open a work session on House Bill 2712. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2712 had a public hearing on April 20th. It is back before us. You should have received yesterday the dash 1 amendment with a hand and gross bill. The dash 1 amendment, we had discussion during the public hearing of the inclusion of folks on FCHIP. The amendments include that. Basically, it expands the period of uninsurance prohibition to include individuals under 19 years of age. And this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Greenlee, can you let us know where we are on this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no opposition to this bill. It was the governor's office that asked that the S-CHIP prohibition be added to this so that it would now be for both. If it passes through Ways and Means, and if the federal government agrees needs to be a waiver request, then there'll be no prior insurance coverage restriction for either FEOP for families with children in FEOP or for children 19 and under in SCHIP. And are we in a work session?
We are in a work session.
I will move the dash 1 amendments to 2712.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Greenlee moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2712. Is there discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I remember that Rocky King was here from ICGB.
Yes.
Said that we needed a waiting period, that we could request even a one-day waiting period, but there had to be some waiting period. Has that been addressed?
No, he actually testified there were 2 states that had no waiting period, but that this would require a federal waiver to get, and this bill will just ask them to attempt to get the waiver.
Okay.
Does that resolve your question?
Yes.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the motion to approve the Dash One amendment? Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash One amendment is ordered adopted. Representative Greenlee?
I move House Bill 2712 to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation, as amended, with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Greenlee moves House Bill 2712 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Budget. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
President Anderson?
Aye.
President Boone?
Aye.
President
Cameron? Vote aye.
President Greenlee?
Aye.
President
Chair?
Aye.
Chair Dalto?
Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 2712, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed and moved to the Committee on Budget. Do we have a recommendation on that? Did I say that we were recommending that we do pass recommendation?
Yes. I move to do pass.
Yes. All right. Thank you. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2712. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2753. Colleagues, we have a little work to do on 2753. Representative Greenlee and I have to visit with Rocky King and the IPGB before we can move this bill. So we'll anticipate being able to accomplish that next week. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2753 and open a work session on House Bill 3049. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3049 is directing the Department of Human Services to adopt rules which, under which a person with developmental disabilities receiving medical assistance and residential services from the department may retain earned income and still remain eligible for services. We've had a couple of discussions on the offset calculations. What you have before you is a hand-engrossed bill with the Dash One amendments. And Mr. DeLashman is here to answer any technical questions.
Brian, just come forward and let us know where we are.
This, too, Mr. Chair, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. Brian DeLashman, here representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. Obviously, the staff has done a briefing. This is a bill that you've seen several times. We reported to you earlier in the week about the direction that we believe we should head as far as the ability for these people to retain some income and still remain eligible. These amendments, in fact, do accomplish that, and we would encourage you to adopt them. And moving on to Ways and Means, where we are having discussions with all the participants in Ways and Means, and they're waiting with bated breath for this bill.
So this important bill. What amendments do we have?
The Dash One amendments, the only amendments that I'm aware of that are in play.
Okay. The blanks are there for the Committee on Ways and Means or the Committee on Budget to fill in. Okay. Representative Cameron, do you have a motion? Mm-hmm. I'll take a motion here. Yeah. On the Dash One amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that House we adopt Dash One amendments to House Bill 3049.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves the Dash One amendments on House Bill 3049. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash One amendments are already adopted. Representative Cameron, to the Committee on Budget, please.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we pass House Bill 3049 to the Committee on Budget for due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3049. That's the Committee on Budget. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3049 to the Committee on Budget, the House Committee on Budget, as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
President Boone?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenlee?
Aye.
President
Tomei?
Aye.
Chair
votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3049, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed and sent to the House Committee on Budget. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3049. Committee will stand at ease for a moment. We have the whole committee back to order. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3268. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3268 requires the Department of Human Services to provide notice to individuals before conducting assessments of service eligibility. It grants individuals the right to appeal changes in the service priority level or change in the services based on that assessment. Committee should have the Dash 7 amendments that were brought forward to the committee by Representative Buckley, who is here to explain this to us.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, House District 5. Thank you very much for taking time to hear this bill. The Dash 7 amendments are the result of a lot of discussion with DHS and various interested parties. To put them in a nutshell, they restore the deleted material in Section 1 of House Bill 3268. They change the period of notice from 10 days to 10 working days in case of an emergency of a loss of funding. That would be the minimal amount of time that clients would have before their evaluation, the reevaluation for services. The amendment also deletes language throughout the bill that makes references to an ability to appeal a change in service priority level, while keeping the ability to appeal an assessment of the activities of daily living that results in reduction or termination of services. We wanted to make sure we would have this focused correctly. We revise language in Section 2 relating to the notice of a reassessment of service eligibility, and we delete the emergency clause to give the department time to do what is our final agreement with them, to have them establish rules by July 1st, 2006, establishing notification procedures regarding reassessments for service eligibility and standards for communication between the individual being assessed and the case managers who are responsible for implementing the notification procedures. Basically, we wanted to make sure that the department had procedures in place where family members and caregivers can be notified of a reassessment of their loved ones. So that's in a nutshell. There is no fiscal on this. We worked very hard to make sure there'd be no fiscal on this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Sounds like the bill's ready to go. Any questions or comments, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only concern I had was that the folks that have to be notified be given the opportunity to notify maybe when the person enters a facility. Yeah, so that there won't be a question of who's to be notified and who's not to be notified. But I think you clarified that they'd have their names in way ahead so that if there is an emergency, it could be dealt with immediately.
Chair, Dr. Representative, that's correct. The department will develop those rules of communication with the families.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or discussion? Okay, thanks, Representative Buckley. Good job.
Thank you.
I will entertain a motion on Dash 7 amendments, please.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3268. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the Dash 7 amendments? See no objection. The Dash 7 amendments are ordered adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3268 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3268, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Buckley is assigned as the carrier. We'll close the House, the work session on House Bill 3268. And open a work session on House Bill 3226. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you will recall House Bill 3226. We had a public hearing on April 11th. This was the bill that is requesting to provide support for mental health and addiction services for seniors and persons with disability, declares an emergency effective on July 1. It had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that the proponents had asked for the committee to rescind. That rescind has been denied. So whatever action the committee so chooses, it is before you in its original version, and I have no amendments.
Can Davis come forward, please?
What are we working on?
32.6. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Where are we at on this measure?
At this point, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are no amendments to the bill. We had asked, since this is simply a policy statement that we wanted inserted in SPD statutes, we asked that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded. Our understanding is that it has not, and we're a little puzzled by that. But then we would ask that that you go ahead and pass it out down to Ways and Means or the Budget Committee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Davis. I did ask, I did receive the statement from the Department of Human Services from Mr. Tate, saying that as far as they interpreted the bill, it was a policy statement, didn't have a fiscal implication. I think that the desire was to see the bill considered in the context of the Department of Human Services budget, in the SPD budget, and so I don't anticipate that with this. It wasn't my indication that it was being sent to Ways and Means for any other reason other than just to do what I just said, and I believe the bill will come out. So it just, unfortunately, will take a little longer, but that's the way of all things, I suppose.
Well, I thank you for all your help, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You need a motion to reconsider?
No, we haven't sent it yet. So thank you, Mr. Davis.
Okay.
We will accept a motion to move this measure to the House Committee on Budget, please.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3226 to the Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Boone?
Aye.
Cameron?
Aye.
Greenland?
Aye.
Chair
Dalton? Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3226, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed and moved to the Committee on Budget. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3226. Open a work session on House Bill 3227. Ask Mr. Davis to come forward. Tim, where are we at on House Bill 3227?
3227 has no amendments, Mr. Chair, and we would like to see it move to the Budget Committee. The one concern that we do have is the fiscal that was attached to it was around $120,000, which would be nowhere close to what this type of a task force would cost. So that was our concern, but it does have a fiscal attached, and we would ask that you send it to the Budget Committee or Ways and Means Committee.
Do you feel like you have an opportunity to work on that fiscal to get one that seems a little more in line with reality?
We certainly could work with DHS on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I need you to state your name for the record, please.
Oh, forgive me. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Coalition for Responsible Treatment and United Seniors of Oregon.
Okay. It sounds to me like we had a discussion once about trying to engage community providers to do some of this work to lighten the fiscal impact on the state for this measure. Is that right?
Yes, they would be willing to do that. I've talked to the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and they are very supportive of this. I'm going to a coalition meeting in a few minutes where I can ask for their assistance on this.
Super.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Your Honor.
Throw something in here. I think this is the bill we made a note on. And to check with the Transportation Department, and they have two task forces, and they're operating, we called Director Warner, their operating expenses are about $50,000. I think it's a freight route, freight whatever, and a rail committee. I don't know if it's a task force or an interim committee or what it is, but it would be worth it to
discuss that, see how they do it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, that seems more a little more in line. And we would envision this task force as maybe holding 6 to 8 meetings and coming up with recommendations for mental health and addiction services for the underserved. And so we wouldn't see any expenses beyond that if that high.
Mr. Chair, do you think it might be helped with an amendment that limited the time scope of the task? I mean, if we charted them to do it within 6 months, say, rather than leaving it open-ended or something like that, would that automatically reduce the fiscal? I mean, this is talking about, I'm sure, an FTE for 18 months.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, yes, I think that might be helpful. And quite frankly, we had suggested that a lot of the coordination of this effort be through the grassroots and through the advocacy and provider communities. So it probably wouldn't even take a full-time FTE, if even a half-time FTE. So if maybe we put some constraints within the language, that might be helpful.
You know, my only concern with amending it in this committee is that this is the last day for consideration of bills, and it might be the case that we could bring the bill back at another time, but I would be worried that we couldn't bring the bill back at another time for whatever reason. And so my question is, because I don't know, I haven't served on Ways and Means, is it possible to amend the bill in Ways and Means or this House Committee on Budget, since it's a standard House committee then that just happens to take up the budget, probably could do it in that committee.
Mr. Chair, I would think that would be a reasonable approach.
Okay, and at that case, you know, at that point they'd be considering the fiscal anyway.
Good.
So it might be reasonable to do it at that point. Does it make sense?
Yes, okay. Very much so.
All right, thank you. Representative Greenlick, can I have a motion, please?
Right. Are we in 2767?
3227.
Here we are. I move 3227 to the House Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 3227 to the House Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No discussion. Oh, Toby. Clerk will call the roll.
President Anderson?
Yes.
President Boone?
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President Greenlick?
Aye.
President
Tomei?
Aye.
Chair
Dolto?
Chair votes aye. Representative Butler is excused. House Bill 3227, having received a constitutional majority, is referred to the House Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. That will close the work session on House Bill 3227. And colleagues, we're I think, done. So what we've come to do for this time, we're going to recess this hearing until 5 o'clock so I can open and close the hearing on the Type A and B hospital bill. And just one announcement for the good of the order. We're going to start on Monday at 9:30. Since we only have two bills to consider, we only have two bills because we sort of transitioned and we hadn't looked at Senate bills yet, and we have a 48-hour rule and all that kind of stuff. So a short program on Monday. Representative Tomei can take a little more time if she's coming in on Monday.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
With that, the committee is in recess until 5 p.m.